We are at war with the countries that fuel our food chain with fertilizers. This war leads us to ask, will there be enough fertilizer to feed our future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the Food Chain, the 1,330th edition of the Food Chain. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Perth who are tuned in the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we are living in a world at war. The world's major powers are now standing in opposition to each other's interests and doing so with all the armaments of political and military warfare. Though the hellfire of this war has not yet reached the United States, that does not mean the U.S. will go untouched. On the contrary, one of the countries the United States stands in opposition to is Russia, which seems to be intent on rebuilding the former glory of the Soviet Union by recapturing territory the USSR once owned, including the breadbasket of the world, the Ukraine. And if Russia is successful in recapturing the Ukraine, why should it stop there? Given this perceived threat, countries of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization have stood up to say no by sealing Russia off with embargoes and guns. Russia, in turn, is sealing off Europe by withdrawing its natural resources from the world's marketplace. Russia's natural resources include hydrocarbon energy and minerals, two of the elements used to manufacture the fertilizers that fuel the world's food chain. This world at war we live in leads us to ask, will there be enough fertilizer to feed our future? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Dr. Amanjana Goswami, who is the interdisciplinary scientist with the Food and Environment Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Goswami, thank you for joining us on the Food Chain today.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here on the show and talk a little bit more about fertilizers and how our food production system is likely to be affected in this war-torn world.
Good. Now, are you a concerned scientist?
I am an extremely concerned scientist. I have a background in environmental sciences, and I've been closely associated with this movement for more than a decade now. And I continue to work in this space because it inspires me, it motivates me, and it makes me want to make the world a better place to live in.
Now, interdisciplinary scientist, I'm a very well acquainted with the whole concept of ecology, which you know, try to see how something that's happening over here can affect something over there. So I understand that your background is in chemistry and what else?
So I started my graduate journey in chemistry, and then I pivoted to studying environmental science, more specifically phosphates in water sources and how we can recover phosphates and use them as fertilizer. Then I pivoted a little bit and pursued a career in science policy. I was actually a science policy fellow on Capitol Hill and spent a year working on legislative issues for a Hawaii congresswoman. And that was a very exciting year. I actually decided that I really, really like the balance of, you know, solving the world's problems through the policy vehicle while not losing my scientist hat. And thus, after I graduated with a PhD in environmental science from Rutgers University, I decided to join the Union of Concerned Scientists, which actually work on all of these issues together. So I work in science, and I use science as a vehicle for recommending policies that then our policy team takes to legislators. And actually, we try to advocate for solutions using science.
Good. Well, let's start by asking you the really big question. As a scientist, Dr. Goswami, do you think there will be enough fertilizer to feed our future?
I think I'll take a step back here before responding to that question and explain what the role of fertilizers is in soil and then sort of pivot to the answer.
Well, so that's what I call a tease, Dr. Goswami. We just want to tease where we're going to go. It's going to take us a little while to get there because
exactly.
I too want to talk about fertilizers and the role they play in our agriculture. So with that, let me ask you an even more fundamental question. Can we grow crops without fertilizers? Dr. Goswami, I ask that question because back in 1900, F.H. King, a former Secretary of Agriculture here in the United States, wrote a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries. In that book, he talked about how farmers growing crops on small parcels of land without any modern fertilizers or equipment fed 400 million Chinese people. And so whenever that's where I always like to start things, because there was a time when we fed a large population without any of the inputs of modern agriculture. So do we need them now? Do we need fertilizers now?
We have traditionally not required fertilizers because the soil itself, where these crops were grown, was fertile. So the three key ingredients of fertilizers include nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Our soils contain natural levels of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and they get replenished in a cyclic manner through the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium cycles. Now, around the time of the Second World War, we saw a boom in these products, these synthetically derived products, which were then advertised as basically, you know, fuel for farmers as the need to sustain high yields and grow produce. Now, what happens is because we have such a large growing population, there is a need to mine soils continuously to sustain the crop. And that became a lucrative sort of scheme to fund these products as what you would absolutely need to grow that. And what happened is over the decades, when you keep adding synthetic fertilizers to soil, the soil loses its natural ability to replenish them.
Why is that? Are we destroying the microorganisms that make these nutrients available?
Exactly. What happens is all of these cycles in soil and turnover and what makes a soil good soil, all of these intricate relationships amongst microbial matter, which we, by the way, are not even able to see with our own eyes. We need a microscope for it. There are millions of living organisms, if not billions, in a tiny spoonful of soil. So what happens is this web of microorganisms and this web of relationships gets destroyed when humans intervene in that process. And now we're looking at decades, if not close to a century, of destroying these relationships.
So in our intervention, we've essentially rendered the soil that was once fertile, infertile. And now we're in desperate need of fertilizers, because without adding fertilizers, there is nothing left in the soil. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And this is the larger role here is, you know, this shift in sort of, you know, mentality of farmers is, you know, and push by the industry who produce these products on a large scale, and they pushed it on to farmers for consumption. But the truth is, there are practices that farmers can adopt to sort of rescale back to not using fertilizers on their crops. And this would require a shift in, of course, their mindset, their practices, and farm management techniques. This branch of agriculture, which is slowly gaining popularity, and there is a good movement in this space, it's called regenerative agriculture. Organic agriculture is a subset of that regenerative agriculture space, which adopts certain practices which eliminates the need for anthropogenic or human-produced chemicals in the soil.
So, in essence, what we are doing with regenerative agriculture is going back to the technologies of those farmers of 40 centuries who were able to grow crops on one parcel of land for 4,000 years without any additives from modern chemistry. Is that a fair summation?
Yes, exactly. You're absolutely correct when you're saying that. And there are studies which have compared long-scale and long-term benefits and yields, of course, because yield is that golden word in production right now, right? You add fertilizers to hit that yield value. So they've compared yield from organic regenerative farms versus commercial farms or conventional farms, and they've seen that in the long term, both practices, there is a higher yield for these organic farms as opposed to conventionally farmed plots of land. Moreover, in organic and in regenerative farming, you're actually adding nutrients back to the soil. You're growing that organic matter. You are reestablishing some of those disrupted relationships. So in a way, you're not stopping reliance on fertilizers. You're actually improving the quality of the soil to sustain itself for a long, long time. Mm-hmm.
And so those farmers of 40 centuries, of course, were feeding their soil all the time. They just weren't feeding them with the chemically derived synthetic fertilizers that we use today. And so as they kept feeding their soil, it kept growing in its fecundity and its ability to yield crops. And it seems as we're the opposite. The more we add our chemical fertilizers, the less fecund the soil becomes and the more dependent it becomes on continuing to add more and more and more outside inputs from outside, fertilizers especially. So that's where we end up facing the fact that we are now relying on fertilizers from Russia. But why? This doesn't make any sense at all to me whatsoever. So that's what we're going to learn when we come back with Dr. Goswami, who is the interdisciplinary scientist with Food and Environment Program, Union of Concerned Scientists. The question on the table today, will we have enough fertilizer to feed our future? Now, there is a threat there, and we must understand the threat. We'll go there when we come back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, let's start with fertilizer itself. And as Dr. Goswami was saying, the three crown jewels of fertilizers are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Russia is a very big producer of these fertilizers for the world. But why is Russia such a big player in the production of these fertilizers? Dr. Goswami, let's start with nitrogen.
You've hit the gold mine there. Russia is actually one of the largest producers of nitrogen fertilizer. And I'll take a quick step back and explain why that is so. So we know that our atmosphere, the air around us, actually contains about 80% or so of nitrogen and the remaining largely is oxygen and other very minute quantities of gaseous matter. So plants are actually unable to use the atmospheric nitrogen for anything. There are microbes in the soil that can convert this atmospheric nitrogen to a form of nitrate and nitrite that then the plant can absorb. But the thing is, in large-scale agriculture, we don't have enough time for this conversion to occur naturally, which then has produced the need to use synthetic nitrogen fertilizers. Now, unlike potassium and phosphorus, which can be mined from ores and are usually extracted from mining deposits, nitrogen fertilizers actually need to be manufactured and produced. What happens in the production of nitrogen fertilizer is the first step is to react nitrogen and hydrogen together to form ammonia. And subsequently, ammonia is used in a variety of chemical reactions to generate solid products that are then basically sold to farmers. Now, the reaction between ammonia and hydrogen is very, very energy intensive. It requires very high temperatures, very high pressures, which means it needs a fuel. And what is this fuel? This fuel is natural gas. And we know Russia has a lot of natural gas to spare. Russia is actually the world's second largest producer of natural gas in the United States. Therefore, natural gas is readily cheap and available in Russia, and they have the right kind of mechanism and manufacturing facilities in place to use this natural gas to form finished products, which are then sold to other countries. So in terms of finished products, we're looking at ammonia, urea, monoammonium phosphate, diammonium phosphate, which agricultural nations buy and use directly in farms.
We to make these fertilizers requires the a lot of energy, and a lot of energy coming from natural gas. Now, the United States has a lot of natural gas too. So why are we importing so much of our nitrogen fertilizers from Russia?
Actually, the U.S. is the largest producer of natural gas in the world, but we consume a lot of our natural gas domestically for producing electricity. So we don't really have a lot left over for production of fertilizers. We do use a certain amount for producing nitrogen fertilizers. But because the U.S. is also a very large agricultural nation, we actually need more than what we are able to produce domestically. And this excess is the one that we buy from other countries like Russia.
Mm-hmm. And how much do we use or how much do we need? I'm thinking mostly of, for example, the corn crops of the Midwest, which would probably be a very nitrogen-intensive crop, correct?
You're absolutely correct. For the corn crops in Midwestern U.S., I think, if I remember correctly, 60% of all the fertilizer that's applied is nitrogen. So you're basically looking at two-thirds of fertilizer application, which forms the nitrogen pool. So I think if I remember correctly my statistics, we are looking at a couple of billion tons of nitrogen fertilizer, which I think 2.9 billion tons of nitrogen fertilizers are produced here domestically, and the rest is imported.
Okay. Do any other countries produce nitrogen fertilizer? I'm thinking, of course, of the Gulf Coast states of Saudi Arabia and whatnot. They have a lot of natural gas.
We actually import natural gas from Trinidad and Tobago, I think a little from Canada, and mostly from Russia, and much lesser quantities from the Gulf states.
Okay. And what happens, what would happen, for example, to the corn crop if we did not put all of that nitrogen on the soil?
Actually, I want I want the listeners to understand that most of the corn crop that's grown in Midwestern U.S., in the corn belt, basically, is not for direct human consumption. It's correct. Actually grown as a commodity crop. Mm-hmm. And that is used as feedstock for cattle and to produce ethanol to fuel our cars.
Right.
So our food chain, in a sense, is not directly dependent on these heavy inputs. What's dependent is the commodity crop chain. And honestly, if you look back at reports on how farmers are faring, especially corn farmers, commodity corn farmers in the Midwest, a lot of farmland is already degraded. And that means that the farmland itself is unable to sustain production at whatever levels we're looking at. The idea now, and it should be implemented ASAP, as early as the next farm bill possible, is to scale back on these inputs. Because in the long run, we're not doing any good by continuing to pump fertilizers and pesticides into the soil.
And that said, if we did not feed the soil with the extra nitrogen, the corn crops that are used for feedstocks for animals would lose a certain percentage of their productivity and would probably lose more the next year and then the year after that and the year after that because there is nothing in the soil to feed the plants then, correct?
I actually do not agree with this statement. Ah. That's because we apply a lot more fertilizers than what the plant needs.
Oh.
In an estimated capacity, out of all of the fertilizers that's added, especially let me give you a statistic in terms of phosphate, plants are only able to extract 16 to 20% of the applied phosphate. What happens to the rest is it remains behind in the soil and gets washed out when it rains or when water is applied and produces a secondary problem, which is called eutrophication. Now, just for the listeners who are not familiar with eutrophication is when excess nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus produce an algal bloom. If you remember, every summer we kind of see ads and news bits about, you know, a eutrophying water body where there's a huge algal growth or algal bloom, and swimming is sometimes prohibited in these water bodies. On a large scale, there is a huge eutrophication problem in the Gulf of Mexico caused by runoff from the Midwest corn belt. So I truly believe that with the current fertilizer consumption and what we have readily available, with the current and properly implemented farm management and application techniques, we would be able to sustain yields.
There you go. That's a challenge to the ag community right there. We can do it without so much fertilizer. The other major nutrients, phosphorus and potassium, are also big exports of Russia, correct?
Phosphorus to a much, much lesser extent. That's because the U.S. actually has a lot of domestic reserves, especially in Florida and North Carolina, of phosphate mines. So we mine a lot of phosphate domestically. Potassium, yes. Most of the potassium is from Canada and then Russia, the remaining bit from Russia.
Good. And how is potash made?
Potash is actually made from a mined ore and then mixed, you know, with other products. Usually, to be honest, no fertilizer product is kind of singularly applied. Usually it's combined with nitrogen or phosphorus, and we add two or more nutrients at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll just give you an example. The product monoammonium phosphate or diammonium phosphate actually contains both phosphorus and nitrogen.
Okay, get a twofer then.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So those are the principal elements, the major macronutrients, as I've come to call them. There are also a number of secondary nutrients as well. Now, does Russia play a role in providing those to the world as well?
I'm sorry, I won't be able to directly answer that, but as far as I know, that micronutrients are actually not supplied by Russia to a large extent.
Okay.
It's mostly micronutrients are present in the soil in a certain capacity, which is sequestered by plants as and when needed.
Okay. Then let's turn to Russia and again ask why they are so dominant in the production. You suggest they have the natural gas to do the heavy lifting of combining nitrogen and what? Hydrogen, correct?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. And it takes a lot of heat, so you combine the two in some kind of pressure cooker and heat it up, and that's what produces the solid material then?
No, that's what produces ammonia. So this process, this chemical reaction, is called the Haber-Bosch process. It's basically named after the two scientists who discovered it. So in the Haber-Bosch process, you get ammonia, and then ammonia can be distilled and liquefied to form nitric acid, which is then used for mixing with products like phosphoric acid, with phosphate fertilizers, as well as with potassium fertilizers, to produce stuff like urea, potassium nitrate, ammonium nitrate, which in the solid form is the fertilizer that's sold in bags.
Okay.
To farmers, basically.
Good. And as mentioned, our industrial model of agriculture has become very dependent upon these things, to the extent that, as Dr. Goswami suggests, we're using too much of it. We don't need all of it, but we are certainly using a lot of it, because that's a lot of what determines the productivity of the crops in the field. And so farmers have a tendency to use as much of it as they can, because that's what gives them the gross weight of their crops. Now, with respect to Russia, where do you see, as somebody who is observing this rather closely, where do you see this fertilizer war shaping up? What's going to happen?
Actually, I'll take two separate perspectives of that. The first one being the United States is less reliant on Russia as the rest of the world. So
right.
We are affected to a much lesser extent. We are affected, definitely, because, you know, the world economy is so connected. We feel the domino effect of any decision, of any sanction that's happening worldwide. So there's no denying that we're going to be affected to some extent.
And do you think, Dr. Goswami, that Europe will be affected more than other countries?
Europe and other Asian and African countries, which directly rely on Russia to a much larger extent than us. We've seen closures of fertilizer manufacturing plants in Europe, especially because Russia has turned off that supply of natural gas. And because there's no natural gas to fuel cars, to produce electricity, and then to produce fertilizers, naturally, Europe has had to take that strong stance and they've had to, you know, shut down fertilizer plants because there's just not enough natural gas to produce and manufacture these. North African nations and other Asian countries depend on Russia to a much larger extent than the U.S. So even though we will likely see a price spike in the coming future, it will be to a much lesser extent than some of these other nations who are directly in the line of fire, basically.
Okay. So we might do relatively okay compared to others, but relatively okay might not mean okay, it could just mean that we'll hurt less than others. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to address that. How much will it hurt us? How much will it hurt others that we're, you know, having these embargoes and we're fighting against each other's interests and a world that was connected and the marketplace was worldwide, and now we're retreating within ourselves and we're losing a lot of those things that we had come to rely on. And this is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. This is the, 1330th edition of the Food Chain with Dr. Omanjana Goswami. I hope I did that right. Who's an interdisciplinary scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And today we're talking about fertilizers. Do we need it? Do we need as much as we use? What happens when it's turned off? We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Now, one thing that I read from you, Dr. Goswami, that captured my attention was that this fertilizer business exacerbates an already inequitable farming system. Now, what did you mean by saying that, by writing that?
So over the past century, our nation's food system has radically transformed from one that is sustained by family farms to a highly industrialized, consolidated model, which is, you know, excessively reliant on high fertilizer inputs, use of excessive pesticides to sustain operations to produce food. But that in itself is not a sustainable practice. Moreover, the system has systematically excluded small farmers, especially farmers of color, black and indigenous farmers, from reaping benefits of this form of sustenance. And we've seen widespread discrimination against farmers of color and indigenous farmers, which is squeezing out the family farming system in favor of these large consolidated farms. Which means that it's actually, you know, exacerbating these inequalities that were already in place and further pushing towards a system that is not at all sustainable.
Okay. Well, it has always seemed to me that it has been the economies of scale that does the discrimination. It seems to me like those who are big have the economies of scale to buy things for less money than those who are small, and also to influence government decision making. I mean, if you have 10,000 acres of something, it's cost you a lot less to influence government than if you have 1 acre of something. So it seems to me that the inequality will always be a function of size. But then I look at that industrial model and I see great opportunity for those who are small, in or near the city to be able to grow crops in or near the city. As opposed to trying to compete with those Goliaths out in the countryside. Does that make any sense?
So growing crops in and near the city, especially, you know, the urban farming movement is kicking off. And in the last farm bill, United States Department of Agriculture actually set up an Office of Urban Farming and appropriated about $25 million towards growing the urban farming model. But that is a very small part of the picture, right? If you're talking of economies of scale, you're still talking about millions of acres of farmland all over the country. And that little drop in the bucket is not going to solve, you know, this larger crisis that's on our hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, what do you think would solve this problem that's on our hands, Dr. Goswami, as an interdisciplinary scientist, I'm sure you've given it a lot of thought. What would that be?
I think the solution lies in creating a more resilient and secure food system by supporting farmers and adopting more sustainable methods like cover cropping and crop rotations. You know, practices that I was talking are a part of the regenerative agricultural model. Mm-hmm. And this cannot happen without farm policy, right? You can't expect farmers to wake up tomorrow morning and be like, I'm going to change what my family, my forefathers have done for generations and just be a better person tomorrow. The world, unfortunately, doesn't work like that. We would love for it to, but it doesn't happen. So what we need is very strong farm policy. And for all of the listeners out there, I'd like to say that we are going into a farm bill reauthorization cycle in the upcoming year. So in 2023, politicians in around D.C. will gather and write a new farm bill. And this is that time to think about how we want to frame that next farm bill.
Do you think a farm bill could give better direction to farmers and in some way encourage them to reduce the amount of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides and all of those very expensive inputs to a more sustainable way of doing things? Do you think a farm bill could do something about that?
There are sections of the farm bill that is devoted to conservation, that is devoted to agriculture, that can definitely, you know, put money in USDA's hand, who then have the discretion to advocate for these policies, to implement these policies. So a farm bill is the most, you know, upcoming and the most plausible solution in our hands. And not just the Union of Concerned Scientists where I work, but a lot of food and farming organizations are getting together to advocate for this equitable and resilient food and farming future that we're talking of. Mm-hmm. So it's not just my own belief or my own thinking and understanding. There are a lot of advocates in this space who are coming together as I speak, who share this idea, who share this belief.
Well, having done 1,330 food chain radio shows, I guess I've kind of featured the same subject many, many, many times. And recall, you know, wasn't that long ago that people were fighting for the word organic, and they won the word organic, and organic kind of became industrial agriculture as a consequence of that. Do you see the same process happening with regenerative? Are people picking up the notion of regenerative, and are consumers? So if organic was easy for consumers, all they had to do is find something that had the organic label on it. But regenerative is a little bit different concept for consumers. How can consumers come to grips with that?
I think the first thing consumers can do is to, you know, listen to us, to read about these practices. And I think that little bit of responsibility also falls on organizations like ours to teach our membership, right? If you're especially interested in supporting a movement, the first idea is to, you know, seek information about that movement. And I think experts and advocates in the regenerative and any food and farming movement, for that matter, are that first voice.
Mm-hmm. And you're part of the Union of Concerned Scientists is Food and Environment. I wanted to ask you about that relationship between food and environment. How do you see them being linked together?
They are absolutely intricately and irrevocably linked together, because a lot of our land is actually used to produce food. And without food, how do we sustain the world's population?
So there you go. If it's a related to food, it's related to environment, and that's that. Looking forward, do you see this regenerative form of agriculture catching hold elsewhere in the world?
Absolutely, and I think even if I don't, because I work in this space, I think you might think my views are a little bit biased, but if it doesn't catch hold, I think the price we pay for it is going to be much, much higher. We have only one Earth, right? This is our home. It's not like we can sit on a spaceship and push ourselves out to the galaxy on a different habitable planet and start from scratch there. So in the short term, the idea is to sort of reestablish the relationships in the soil that I was talking about through this movement, because without it, you know, we cannot continue consuming toxic amounts of fertilizers and pesticides and expect the earth, the soil, to keep pumping out food.
Because it won't.
It just won't. Because earth has sort of a regenerative capacity, but the way we are extracting these resources and expecting it to function, the pace at which we are growing food is just not sustainable for these relationships, for that imbalance to heal naturally.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty easy to see how this regenerative form of agriculture can be made to work on small parcels of land. But I'm not sure if I can see how it can be made to work on very large parcels of land. It seems like the farmer becomes so much more important in a regenerative form of agriculture than in an industrial form. Because in an industrial form, all you have to do is spread X number of pounds of this over per acre, and everything will work out just fine. But with a regenerative form of agriculture, I think it just takes a lot more smarts.
I actually don't believe that. That's because regenerative agriculture is not a single practice. It's not as simple as ABC. I agree with that bit. But there are practices in conjunction that you can use, like cover cropping, mm-hmm. and crop rotation and no tillage, and or growing, you know, legumes in one season and then planting something else like soy in the next season. All of that is actually going to yield a much more sustainable and better producing system. So I think a little investment, education most importantly, and change in practices up front can, in the long run, you know, establish what we are seeing today with industrialized agriculture. It's almost a no-brainer today, right? But it wasn't a no-brainer 50 years ago when farmers were still figuring out, I need X amount of fertilizers on X hectares or X acres of land.
You know, I having been kind of an amateur sinologist, I'm very fascinated with China. And I especially hold dear that book by F.H. King, Farmers of 40 Centuries. And I look at China today, and I see that they have taken pretty much most everybody off the farmland and moved them into the city to work in factories, and thus giving China a great leg up on the cost of running factories. But so much of that, that knowledge, the technology of cover cropping and crop rotation and crop compatibility and companion plants and so on and so on and so on, that farmers learned over many centuries of growing crops on a little parcel of land, so much of that technology is gone now, and China is forced to rely on industrial methods on soils that have been very much degraded by industrial processes and the growth of cities. So I wonder, has anybody addressed regenerative agriculture with the CCP?
I don't think I have enough knowledge to answer that question, honestly, and I want to do justice when framing that question. But conservation land in particular is a big component of Farm Bill, because we truly believe that land that's been, you know, harmed by some of these practices, if farmers can set aside that land and gain, you know, X amount of dollars per acre for, you know, allowing that land to replenish and to build back that soil organic matter, that land can then be put to production on a much better sort of scale and see a much better output in the long run.
Okay.
So the Farm Bill actually assists by promoting conservation practices, and there's an entire title on that. And I'm sure, you know, people who are a part of this movement, or even listeners, general listeners who keep track of it, would know that the conservation program is a very important tool for conserving lands in the country,
right,
or farmlands in the country.
The crops that have been harvested this fall were largely grown with fertilizers that were purchased before the war in the Ukraine. Next year's crops will be grown with wartime prices. What do you see will be the impact of prices on food in the coming years?
I actually believe that we are likely to witness a food price spike in addition to the inflation we are seeing now.
Dr. Omanjana Goswami, who is an interdisciplinary scientist from Union of Concerned Scientists, I want to thank you all for tuning in and ask you to remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, for taking the time to talk to me. And thank you, everybody, for listening in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.